Okay, Erev Tov, we're certainly up and running. We've got another three shiurim, I think, before the end of this particular part of the season. So obviously we'll be running through Hanukkah, hopefully. I just want to again dedicate this evening to, in memory of the Shloshim, which is being commemorated this evening, of Yossi Shachnovitz, who we mentioned a few weeks ago. Zichron Livrocha, who really was a very special individual, and I think was someone who we just did not appreciate while he was with us. Just one story about him. I remember my wife started a gemach, which was for wedding dresses. This was a number of years ago. And she announced it. It was announced in the Shul Bulletin, the Shomer Torah, I think, on the Shabbos. And literally on the Sunday night, Monday morning, there was a knock on the door, and Yossi was standing there. So we said, Yossi, is your daughter getting married? She was like, I think at that time she was like 14 years old, the oldest child. So he said, no, he's just come to donate to the gemach. He wanted immediately to make sure that there was money in the kitty to buy more dresses and whatever. Wrote out a check straight away. It was unbelievable. And apparently he was like this all the time. This is the way he was, Shachnovitz, Yossi Shachnovitz. Very special individual, and I'll never forget that. And I told his father-in-law about it. And he said, he wasn't surprised. He said, this is stories that they've been hearing, over and over again. Good evening. They've been hearing these stories through the Shiva, now through the Shloshim. And I just hope he'll be a Melech Yosher. The Eretz Yisrael, we need a lot of good people to defend us at the moment. They're praying for rain. They made a fast day last week. We're clearly having issues in terms of, what's going on in Eretz Yisrael. Just to mention, last week, my wife attended a talk from a Chavar Knesset, who is an Ethiopian, Shlomo Moller, his name is, and he announced to the audience, and it was an APAC meeting, there are three real problems in Israel. Number one was Iran. Number two, he said, was the Palestinians. Number three, he said, was the Orthodox. Unbelievable. And that is considered to be in the same breath as the problem with Iran, is the problem with particularly with the Haredim, as they call them, the right-wing Orthodox groups, and it's just quite disturbing. So we need a lot of Chasdei Hashem at this point, really, just to sort of overcome these particular issues and work it out.
Was he Orthodox, this guy?
No. No, and he's...
He wouldn't say the left wing.
So without getting into a political...
You've got to take that with a big grain of salt.
Absolutely, but it's just depressing that somebody who's come from Ethiopia without all the baggage of everything that we grew up with has already perceived that there is an issue in Israel, in the society. I mean, that is really, really upsetting. But, the reality is there is a problem there. All right. Why do I say all this? Because when we're talking about chapter 4, and I think we may even get through chapter 5 this evening, we're looking at the time in Jewish history, in Sefer Melachim, when things were about as good as they're ever going to be, or at least till now. I know we've got the malls and we've got the highways, and in Israel today is just an unbelievable place in so many issues. But in those days, with Shlomo HaMelech, there was a sense of purpose, which we'll read about here, which is absolutely amazing. Perek Dalet we'll do very, very quickly, because there really is a list of names. I've got a few things I want to show you at the end, just in terms of things I mentioned originally from the Abarbanel, who really sees this as a model for government in Spain in the 1400s, and he talks about it, which is amazing, because Shlomo Melech's government was 2,000 years before the Abarbanel ever lived. Just shows how advanced Shlomo was, and remarkable things going on. The Perek Dalet that I normally teach as a lesson, I would spend a whole lesson talking about civics, because what I end up talking about is getting the students to give me a list of all the requirements of a government, in terms of branches and who makes up the cabinet and everything else, and then show you that Shlomo had it all covered. Not only that, but he didn't even have the what they call the mishugas of America, of separation of religion and state, which for some people is very important, for other people becomes a real challenge. Shlomo, in Israel, there's clearly not going to be an issue with that. And he's covered all the bases. He's covered, it's unbelievable. I'll just show you, we'll just read through very quickly Perek Dalet. And it's again, page 23 in the blue book, and 38 in the red book. So you say to me, what is that telling us? The king Shlomo was king over all of Israel. But again, maybe the emphasis on Melech, that now he's established this Derech HaMelech, this idea of the king functioning as king in a sense that not only is there going to be a state which is going to reflect, obviously, Torah values, but it's also going to reflect the wisdom of the king. And I think that's one of the issues which we'll talk about. And also, there's a, most of the Mefarshim say, well, this is in comparison to David. Just a second, in comparison to David, who did not manage to become Melech al Kol Yisrael for 7 years. He was only in Hebron, and he didn't come to Yerushalayim until 7 years later. Whereas Shlomo, he was Melech straight away, more or less. Yeah.
I don't think there was ever a dichotomy in the early kings of Israel between Torah values and non-Torah values.
No.
That's a much later.
Yeah. They follow the Torah. Yeah, but what I'm saying is that what we saw with the Mishpat Shlomo is that he also is developing a kind of parallel system, where what we would call nowadays Dina de Malchuta, all right, where we don't have a specific, or the remedy is not the greatest remedy. As we explained last week, you can't just go for the halacha of a Moshe Mechaver in that case. So he produces a halacha, he produces a solution, and he does this a lot. Shlomo, as you'll see, is described as being really someone who is respected for his wisdom, his expression of the way he looks at the world. It's very interesting. So again, just to sort of by way of introduction, and we'll just run through the whole list of names here, Pasuk Beis. Ve'elas Sarim Asher Lo, he has the following officers in the government: Azario ben Tzadok HaKohen. So obviously the first is to the Kohen, so he's got the religious side of things covered. In England, this would be the chief rabbi or the Archbishop of Canterbury, depending on which direction you're going. And then Gimel Elichorev Achio Bnei Shisha Sofrim. These are the scribes. They're the ones who write down all the matters of state and record everything. And Yoshafat, excuse me, Ben Achilud Hamaskir, the Secretary of State. Okay, which again is something we would recognize as a position today. Ubenayo ben Yodal Atzavah, and you've got the head of the army, the minister of the Secretary of Defense. Okay, but Tzadok of Yatak Kohanim, and also you've got high priests in place as well. You had Azariah was presumably the Kohen Gadol, and then you had these other Sagane Kohanim. If it's that way around, it might be the other way around. We're not quite sure. And then you have a whole series of delegation, like you have in this country where you have state law and you have federal law. So Shlomo had the same kind of, not the same, but a similar style. He had Azariah ben Natan al Nitzavim. The Nitzavim were the people in charge, I suppose now as you would say, the governor of the state. So the country was divided into 12 sections according to the tribes of Israel. And you had somebody who was in charge of all the 12 governors, all right, a governor above the governors. The Zavud ben Natan Kohen, Rea HaMelech. And you also had someone who was Rea HaMelech. Rea HaMelech is a very important position. It's the confidant of the king. Someone who the king could schmooze to, the king could talk to. You know, everybody in a position of leadership has Rea. I always remember the pictures of Lubavitcher Rebbe going to the gravesite. All right, Rea HaRebbe in that case was his father-in-law, even though his father-in-law had died. But presumably when he went to the oil and he was there for hours, standing, never sat down, he stood there and he was there for hours and hours, one assumes that there was some sort of inspiration that he got from that particular place. It just is quite interesting. And again, this is all sort of part of what government is about. I always talk about the West Wing, which is a program a lot of people enjoyed when it was around. And you had Rea HaMelech. I've forgotten the name of the character now, but there was somebody who was definitely a confidant of the president. And I'm sure Mr. Obama has his own people that he talks to, some of whom we may have heard of, some of whom we probably haven't heard of. The Achishar al Abayit, you have to have somebody in charge of the household. All right, this I recognize certainly from an English point of view, somebody who's in charge of the palace. Vadoniram ben Avdala Mas, and of course somebody who's in charge of taxes. You've got to have the IRS represented in government. Ushlomo Shneimasa Nitzavim al Kol Israel. Shlomo had 12 officers over the whole of Israel. The Kilkulat Amelech Bet Beito Chodesh Peshana Yiyah Kol Al Echal Echagah. Basically, what happened was he decided that he was going to generate the economy in a very interesting way, by getting one tribe per month to supply the food of the palace. So he would be then paying them for doing this job. And during the year, the whole of Israel would be involved in that particular project. Every month, another tribe would supply the food, and things would generate income, and obviously money would make the world go around in those days, as it tends to do to this very day. So there is a kind of interesting sort of economic model without going into too much detail. I had a student who was a political science major that when I taught this a number of years ago, who gave me a tremendous essay, which I've got at home somewhere. I've got nowhere to put it. I stored it away because it was just so interesting how she saw, in terms of her political science studies, so much the roots of what she was learning in this particular chapter, which was very exciting. So again, you know, I'm just trying to sort of make it as practical as we can. And again, who are these people who are in the Netzivim? We'll run through this very quickly. Chet, with chapter 4, verse 8. Ve'ele shmotam ben Chur b'Har Ephraim, ben Deka b'Mokatz, b'Shalabim u'Beit Shemesh. That whole area, which is well known today, Beilon, Beit Hanan, Elotim in Beit Hanan, Ben Chesed, Barubot. These are all names and places. A place called Arubot. Lo Socho, V'chol Eretz Chefa. He was in charge of Socho and the land of Chefa. Ben Avinadav, Kol Nafat Doa. He was in a place called Nafat Doa. Tofat Bat Shlomo. And interesting, the daughter of Shlomo. All right, Tofat Bat Shlomo Haita Lo Lisha was his wife. In other words, this is Shlomo's son-in-law. Okay, so this is a very unique reference to one of Shlomo's children. We only really read about, I think there's two daughters that we hear about, and obviously Rechavam, the son. He must have had a lot of children, yes.
So, but this, they're listing names, and it makes it sound like he started his monarchy, and then within a few years, these all the people involved.
Yeah.
To have a daughter married to somebody, girl's got to be 16.
That's
yeah. 30 years old.
Yeah.
When she got married.
Yeah. Again, what's happening here? Of course, this is all written with hindsight. This is not written by Shlomo. This is written by Yirmiyahu much, much later, and with hindsight. So my guess is that he looked over the whole period and he recorded who got these jobs over the course of time. This is not one period of time. This is presumably a development of time. So one can assume that this is a later appointment. His daughter, you know, Yichus, right? You know, it's protector, who you know, and who you're married to in this case, and that's the way it works. So it's kind of interesting just to see that. But there may be other explanations, I don't know. I'm just coming to terms with the fact that Achitofel, one of my students pointed out to me, somebody we learned about last semester, was the grandfather of Bathsheba, who David, you know, sort of basically she became David's wife. Now, Achitofel died when he was 33 years old. So if that's the case, he was the grandfather of Bathsheba. How old was Bathsheba in the whole story of David? Makes her incredibly young. All right? Now, again, you know, you'll tell me, well, you heard from your Baba that, you know, in Europe, girls got married very young, 13 and 14. I mean, that was, you know, so different societies. We just are not used to this. As far as we're concerned, you know, the age of consent is sort of up there at 16 or 18. And 19. Wow. So twin children. Hey. Yeah, all right. So again, it's not the common, but it happens. So yeah, all of the ages here are very unusual, I suppose, for us. But again, for the world that this is happening, not so unusual. We'll just run through again, just a little bit more. You'd bet. Bana ben Achilud, Ta'anach, these are all names of places, and Megiddo, this is towards the north. Ta'anach is an area now that you can drive through if you go on the road towards Tiberias. You go through the area known as Ta'anach, and Megiddo, very famous, Chol Beit Shan, and Beit Shan, which is probably the hottest place I've ever been to. Asher Eitzot Tzartana, Mitachal Yisrael, in the valley of near the valley of Yisrael. Mi Beit Shan, Adava Mechola, to a place called Mechola. All right, and these are names which have been revived in the modern day. So it's all very kind of significant that these names have come back. And then Ben Geva Baramat Gilad, Lo Chavot Yair Ben Menashe, and he was in charge of this area known as Chavot Yair Ben Menashe, the area which had been dedicated by Yair, the son of Menashe, Asher BeGilad, Lo Chevel Argov, the area known as Argov, Asher BeBashan, in the Bashan, Shishim Arim Gedolod, he was in charge of 60 large villages, interesting, or cities, Choma Briach Nechoshe, which were locked up with gates, basically, with a pole, you know, sort of a post to make sure that it was locked. Achinadav ben Ido, Machnaima, Achinadav was in the place called Machanaim. Achimaz ben Naphtali, he was in charge. Naphtali, Gamula, Kachet, Bosmat, Bat Shlomo. So another son-in-law, Leisha. So he was the second son-in-law, Achimaz ben Naphtali. Okay, so again, we've got two daughters of Shlomo that are mentioned here, which again is significant, and we're going to eventually sort of make a reference to this in future shiurim. Ted Zayin, Bana ben Hushai ba'Asher ba'Alod, Yoshava ben Paroch b'Yisachar, Shimi ben Eila b'Binyamin, and Geva ben Uri b'Eretz Gilad, and it goes on and on. Eretz Sichon, Eretz Emori, v'Og melech Bashan. So he was in charge of that whole area, which really was outside Israel, what we would call today Jordan. And there was one officer in the land. In other words, we understand that maybe the one extra person was representing them in their particular place or whatever it was. It's not clear exactly all the divisions, but basically the country is divided up into these sections. Yehuda v'Yisrael rabim k'chol asher layam larov, and Yehuda and Israel were many, like the sand on the sea. Ochlim shotim usmechim. This is a good introduction to a wedding speech. Eat, drink, and be merry. They were drinking and eating, and they were merry. They were happy. There was this sense of Seder. And this is what I think is so precious about chapter 4, is that when you're in a country where there is a Seder, where there's a government, it just, you know, you can sleep at night. I just don't know how people, when they live under a regime where the government is corrupt or whatever, you just can't sleep. You don't know what's going to happen next. I mean, the obvious example is sort of thinking in terms back into the world of Germany before the war, and obviously that must have been very, very challenging and very, very difficult, and all the events, without going into the sort of Holocaust period, just prior to that. And when you're in a country where the government is just so corrupt or so disorganized or whatever it may be, you know, it's one of those things that is when you live under, you know, like we live here, we all take it for granted. But when we hear about other countries where there's corruption in government and the elections are corrupt and everything else, that gives a tremendous sense of lack of confidence in where you're living. And here, by the very expression, Ochlim Shotim Smechim, meaning, of course, it's a very physical representation of what they were doing, it's also a sign of great content. They were very content with the circumstance where and how it was working out for them. And of course, as I said, this is a period in Jewish history which has not really been repeated. Certainly, you'll see by the time we get to the end of Shlomo, things are already beginning to get difficult, and then it just goes down and down and down, not really getting back to this level, really, you can say, till today. Thank God that the standard of living in Israel is getting higher and higher the whole time, but of course there still is a lot of the issues that we have to deal with, which Shlomo already covered, and we'll talk a bit more about that in a second. Yeah, yeah, it's always Yehuda and Yisrael. They always divide them. Yehuda has always been given a kind of special position, and we see that all the way through the book of Shmuel. Yehuda, really going back through the book of Shoftim, it starts right at the beginning of Shoftim, when after Yehoshua dies, the question was, Mi Yala, who's going to lead us? And it says Yehuda Yala. What does it mean, Yehuda? It doesn't mean one person. It means the tribe. So the tribe always had a special position, was counted separately, as you'll see, if you look back at the end of Shmuel Bet, you'll see the David counted separately, because it's obviously his people anyway. But more than that, it's always Yehuda had that special position in the Jewish people. And here it's reflected again to the point where they come before Yisrael. And of course, it's also an echo of the future, because we know Yehuda and Yisrael are going to go their separate ways. All right, so it's kind of setting up the scene. Maybe this is again Yirmiyahu, the writer of the book, setting the pattern so that when it does split, we'll know what we're dealing with, which groups. Right, so that's another possibility. So, but we get this very often in the Sefer. So that's chapter 4. And again, I'm just going to show you a little bit in a few minutes, but I just want to look at chapter 5 very quickly, and we'll see where we're going with this. Pasuk Aleph of chapter 5, Shlomo Yom Moshe B'chol HaMamlachot, Min HaNahar Etz Plishtim V'ad Gevul Mitzrayim. He was ruling over all of the kingdoms, basically. In other words, all of the different regions from the Har Eretz Plishtim, from the river, from the land of the Plishtim, which is sort of to the west, presumably Mediterranean, right? Ad Gavul Mitzrayim, to the border of Egypt. Magishim in Ha'as. So, sorry. He was in a position where even there were foreign countries that they were ruling over, I suppose, from the days of David, when David conquered all these places, and maybe in other circumstances, and they would be Magishim Mincha, they would bring some sort of tribute to him, Ve'ovdim et Shlomo, Kol Yimei Chayav, and serve Shlomo all the days of his life. In other words, Shlomo had this sense of not only majesty within the boundaries of Israel, but even out from outside. People would become attached to him. There is a whole halachic debate, which is very interesting, about whether they accepted Gerim during the time of David and Shlomo. Because when the Yad Yisro Takifa, the Gemara says, when the hand of Israel is very strong, is in control, then Gerim is not such a good thing for us, because we have a suspicion about the motivation. The motivation may be, well, you know, the Jews are riding high, so let's join jump on the bandwagon and let's become Jewish. It's interesting that, of course, in this generation, it's become sort of a whole issue again in Israel, and this is now a very hot debate all over again about the whole question of conversion. It's always been something that's with us. Remember we said with Shlomo, of course, the exception was Shlomo himself, who, according to all opinions, did convert the women that he married. One of the things that we've got to come to terms with is Shlomo's, I suppose we would call it, bending the law into an extreme. The king was not allowed to marry more than 18 wives. That was the tradition, learned from Sukkim. The king was not allowed to have lo yabra lo susim, not allowed too many horses. He wasn't allowed to have too much kesev or zahav, gold and silver. There has to be moderation. Shlomo pushed all the boundaries of moderation out of the window. And as you'll see already in this chapter 5, it gives us some concept of what Shlomo's kingdom was really like. Listen to this, Pasuk Beis. And I'm going to share with you a bit of a barbin in a minute, just to make it a bit more real, because it is unbelievable. Even the Queen of England cannot match this. Pasuk Beis. Vayihi lechem Shlomo. Liyom echad. How much bread did he get through in one day? It's not talking about him. All right, you know, you eat a slice of bread or half a loaf of bread. He's talking about his palace. Shloshim kor solat, 30 measures of solat, of fine flour. Veshishim kor kemach, and 60 measures of regular flour. Now, the measure of flour is enormous. It's like a bag of flour. So if you put all this flour and you start making bread, you can see you're going to be making hundreds upon hundreds of loaves of bread every single day. And not only that, gimel, asara bakabriyim, 10 animals. All right, 10 whole animals, which was served every day. Vestrim bakar rei, 20 animals, which the 10 were oxen, the 20 were rei, were in the pasture. Or he says from the pasture, umeyat son, and there was 100 sheep. I mean, this is enormous amount of meat. I mean, it's for meat and potato guys. This is a dream. Levad me'ayalot tzvi v'yachmur, and then you also had some of the extra things, the fatted animals, the ayal, I've got to go by the translation there, the harts, the deers, yachmor, the fallow deers, barbarim avusim, and of course the barbarim, which we talk about on the Zemiris on Shabbos, right? Barbarim v'dogim, or whatever we say. And barbarim is the fatted fowls, right? All of this type of opulence and success and materialism is in abundance in the days of Shlomo. And it says, Dalet, ki hu rodeh b'cholev anar, mitivsach ad Aza, because he literally was ruling from these two places, from Gaza till Tifsa. Tifsa presumably was on the other side of the country. B'chol machev anar, over all the kings on that side of the river, meaning presumably sort of kingdoms which with the kingdom of Israel sort of spread out in terms of control even beyond the boundaries. V'sholom hayolo mikol avrav saviv, and this is an unbelievable statement. And we pray for this. This is something that we read about from Shlomo, and we realize it is attainable. But the way Shlomo went about it is beyond belief. We have peace in this time, mikol avrav misavim, from every side of the country. There was nobody who was remotely lining up to attack Israel at that time. It's amazing. And of course, this famous pasuk, hey, Vayeshev Yehuda v'Yisrael levetach ish tachat gafno tachat teinato. Each man sat confident, as it were, under his vine and under his fig tree. Midan ad Beersheva, Dan is right in the north, to the nowadays the Golan, right down to Beersheva, at the bottom of the boundary of Israel. In those days, Kol Yimei Shlomo, all the days of Shlomo. It's a chalom. It's an absolute chalom. Yeah.
And yet you have no mention at all that there was any Talmud Torah.
There's no... Everything is mentioned in the physical realm. And of course, this is very much the style of Torah. When you think about it, the second parak of Shema says, keep the Torah, and what will happen to you? You'll get rain. And you'll have a chalt of a sabbat of erachta. It doesn't say that you'll be able to open up new yeshivas. It doesn't say that. So always the Torah always talked in material terms, because this is what we really relate to. And then from the material, we can go on to build spiritual. And as I mentioned already before, Shlomo's derech was itaruta delatata. He was going to take everything from the grassroots and make it holy. All right, this idea of sanctifying the surrounding, sanctifying the material world, that was Shlomo's derech. And he did this in abundance, and for two reasons. Reason number one, clearly, was that this was his way of getting closer to Hashem, and it was going to reflect itself in building the in the Beit HaMikdash, building the temple. But reason number two was that, as we see in the next pasuk, he had to make an impression on the people around. If the enemies of Israel, and they didn't just disappear, the enemies were there, because we know later on they come back again. Egypt is waiting to attack. But at this point in time, Shlomo has made a political alliance with Egypt by marrying the daughter of Pharaoh. So he's well in there in terms of the family. And not only that, but you know what? Just in case they sort of think, well, maybe we can make a skirmish here, or we can have a little attack there, he just lays on the most unbelievable number of horses. And that, of course, today will be the equivalent of how many tanks and who knows what sort of weapons that you would have, just to show the world that he is ready for any eventuality. It's a show of power which really is remarkable. And this is Pasuk Vav. Vayhi l'shlomo ba'im elef uruvot susim. He had 40,000 stables. Now, how many horses in a stable? If you say there's like 10 horses in a stable, it's 400,000 horses. Now, when the Torah says lo yar below susim, that is, you know, with all due respect, that's a lot of horses. Even if you say it was four in a stable, I mean, whatever it is, it's enormous. Le Merkavo, this was all for the chariots, right? Ushnei Masa Eleprashim, 12,000 riders. So this is just going bigger and bigger and bigger. And who supports all of this? You need money for this. In other words, who feeds all the people? He's got people in the palace. He's got to feed them all. So all of these nitzavim, as I explained, they provided the food to the king. Each one by the month. So you had the first month would be the tribe of whatever. Second month would be, you know, Shimon. Then it would be Naphtali. And then it would be whatever. How they worked it out. And they all sent food on a monthly basis. Lo yadru davar, nothing was lacking. And Chazal say that they would even get fruits. Like nowadays, we take it for granted that you can walk into ShopRite and get a fruit the whole year round. Right? Once upon a time, it was seasonal. Always remember Rosh Hashanah, you know, what did we have as a new fruit? It was always the kiwi fruit, because in England, that's what you got Rosh Hashanah. You didn't get it the whole year round. Now you can get kiwi fruit the whole time. So getting the Shekhianu today is a bit more challenging than it used to be in the old days. But in the days of Shlomo, they had fruits the whole year round. It's remarkable. And we're just going to do a little bit more, and then I'll show you some of the comments here, particularly the Barbina. It's so interesting. And he says, Vasa'orim va'tevin asusim la'rechesh. He had so much straw for the salt, for the horses, etc. Yavio la'mokam, hashi yasham ishkim ishpoto. Each one brought as much as he was required to do. And finally, the final point I want to talk to, we'll stop in the middle of the chapter. Shlomo's wisdom became even greater. God gave him more wisdom and understanding. He had this tremendously breadth of heart, which was as broad as the seashore. Okay, and again, this is a metaphor which is used over and over again, and we may say something about that as well. His wisdom, and it's not about, again, Chochmat HaTorah here, but we all understand, Chazal explained, through his knowledge of Torah, he became more and more connected to the world, and then his wisdom increased. It was greater than the wisdom of all B'nai Kedem, the whole of the early people who lived in that area. Kol Chochmat Mitzrayim, he was greater than the wisdom of Egypt. And there's a wonderful story here. That how did he outdo the Egyptian wisdom? Is that when they were asking for people to come and build the Beit HaMikdash, So it says that the Egyptians didn't want to be too generous. So they sent a whole bunch of engineers, but they knew through their chokhmah that all these engineers were very sick people. They would not live longer than a year. This is a midrashic story. And what happened was, they all arrived in Israel, probably, who knows, a couple of dozen of these guys. So what did Shlomo do? He knew that they'd been sent to Israel, and they weren't going to last very long. So he said, "I'm sorry guys, I'm sending you home with your shrouds." He actually took Tachrichin and he said, "Go home, take your shrouds, go back to Mitzrayim, go back to Egypt." Unbelievable. They must have blown their minds. You know, here they are trying to outwit him, and he was even greater. You know, he sent back the messengers, as it were, with the appropriate comment. It's just beyond belief. Pasuk Yudal, Vayechkam mikol adam, he was greater than all men in wisdom, from Eitan Ezrachi. These are names of people who were in the Middle East at the time. One assumes they were famous in their day, from a guy called Eitan, Haman and Haman, V'chalko, V'darada, B'nei Machol, who were the sons of Machol, V'hishma, V'cholokoyim Savim, and everybody spoke his name. And just a little bit more, which you mentioned before, V'edabeh Shloshet Alafim Mashal, he gave 3,000 parables. We have the book of Mishlei, which doesn't have 3,000. So many of these were lost. V'hishiro, Chamisha, V'elev, and he had 1,005 songs. We have basically Shir Shirim, the Song of Songs, which we have as a remnant. So again, who knows what literature was generated by Shlomo, what is known in the classical terminology as the wisdom literature, which is now no longer with us. Vayadabe al ha'etzim, and finally he spoke about the trees. Some say he spoke to the trees, as we mentioned a few weeks ago. Min ha'erez asher b'levanon, from the cedars, or he knew about the cedar trees, Vada Izov, to the hyssop, to the numbers, from large, from giant trees to the smallest tree. He knew all about Asher Yotzei Bakir, which grows in the walls. You see that, the kotel, that green that comes out. Vayidaber al beimah, v'la'ov, v'la'remes, v'la'dagim, and he, as I said, he had this kind of ability to talk to the animals. Every animal. Vayavok mikol ha'amim lishma et chachmat Shlomo, they all came to listen to him. Who heard about his wisdom. So Shlomo was the flavor of the month. He probably would hold some sort of lecture series, and people would come from all over the Middle East to listen to the wisdom of Shlomo. It's just, it's beyond, it's breathtaking, all of this. I just want to share with you just a couple of he'arot, because this is something worth seeing. Just maybe you can hand these out very quickly. Thank you. We'll finish Mitz Hashem the perek next week, because there's a special issue here with getting the materials together for the Beit HaMikdash. But I just want to show you here a little bit of background. Not so much really even about the chapter that we read, but the comments of the Abarbanel. Abarbanel lived in Spain, as we mentioned already a number of times. He was a man of the court of Spain. And in his commentary here, when he talks about Shlomo's court, I'm sorry it's so small, I'll just read, I'm not going to read it all, we'll just take a little bit of it. What the Abarbanel does is makes comparisons to his own day. And this to me is just such a revelation, that he saw this Perek Dalet, and clearly also Perek Hay, as we'll see, he saw this not as a historical record, but as a guideline, you know, something that he saw in his own day. The wisdom of Shlomo was so great that it set the parameters of government, which was still around over 2,000 years later in Spain in the 1400s. And just have a look at section A on the right-hand side, just to give you some idea. He's talking about some of the appointments, right? He says, Uladati, this is the Abarbanel, again, 14th century, 1400s in Spain. Uladati haya maskir huamamune. Who is the maskir? We have one of the appointments was the secretary. What does he do? Huamamune liskor lifnei amele. He reminds the king of all the protocol. All right, there's a lot of people in England who do that. There's a lot of people who sort of, you know, are the advisors, the civil servants, who remind the prime minister what to say, and have it in this country as well. Ubn Khasav and about his possessions or whatever. You know, they are the keepers of the record. Vadvarim aruim elav kafi adim, where everything that should be done according to the law. Vayad doresh tamid zechuto laviach memono. They always were looking to increase the moment, the monetary, you know, there was to balance the payments, right? You know, to sort of helping with all of the matters of government. But gam hayom hazeh, this is what I wanted to bring to you. He says, even today, and he's writing in Spain around you know, the late 1400. Remember, he was thrown out in 1492. He says, "Gam hayom hazeh nimshach haminhag." It's the custom. Sheyeh tamid bebeit hamelachim. There's always somebody in the house of the kings. Ish echad memuneh, an appointee, al zeh, to do this. Vayikru beloshen edom. What is he called in Latin? He's called procurator fiscal. Fiscal, this is actually in Scotland, it's still used the term of the procurator fiscal to this very day. Somebody in charge of the treasury. The procurator fiscal, it's a term which is still used as a political position in Scotland. It just blows my mind when he says, "Gama yom hazeh," today I can relate to this. If you just look down that column at the end, where he says, I've underlined it, just the same column, but right at the bottom of that column, the last four lines, "V'gama yom, yesh b'chom mamlechot eretz edom ha-minag hazeh." He's talking about another appointment, which he claims was in fact someone who used to come and make jest with the audience. Maybe that was one of the jobs which he speaks about here. There was one appointee who used to come along who would be in charge of different things. I think he's talking here, if I'm not mistaken. It's not the jester. The jester was in the middle section, which I didn't talk about. He talks here about someone who is in charge of the economics, someone who buys the food, someone who's in charge of that. And he says, nowadays, Hayom yesh b'chom mamlechot eretz Edom min hagazeh, in all the lands of Edom, meaning Spain and Italy and wherever, the same custom, kimuvad netzivei hamelech ha'ochim imo hamunim ha'mazonot, apart from the people who are in charge of the supply of food, etc., hine od yibne ir memuneh mitachad yada, there's also another appointee in every city, v'nikra b'lashonon al-mutasin. Al-Mutasin, as far as I could work out, I tried to ask some of the girls from South America if they recognized this word in Spanish, and none of them could help me out at all. It's obviously very, sort of an old-fashioned word, but it seems to be like someone who is it's a word for civil servant, someone who is in charge of the civil service, who's in charge of providing the food, bringing all of those things into the country, and being in control. If you look at section C on the left-hand side, just want to give you some idea of what's going on here, what the Barbanel does. Right in the middle of that section, you'll see it's about sort of 12 lines up. I've underlined it. Hanohug b'mamlechot Portugal eretz moladati. He's trying to work out what are all of these measurements of the food that we just read about, the oil and the flour and the animals, how does it relate to what he is used to? Nowadays we would say pounds and ounces or kilograms, you know, depending where you are. And in his day, he says, how does it measure to what we have in Portugal, which seemingly was the country which created the standard for the whole of that particular part of the world? So he starts writing about this, and if you just look down, where he talks about all the various animals, just where the next underlining, if you're with me, it's about six lines up. Yachmora heim buffaloes, right? Or something to that effect. I'm not sure if that's what he's referring to. Ubarburim avusim heim ofot ashmenim. We know that the barburim were these fattened fowl, hamafutamim alidei b'nei adam b'bayit. They used to fatten them in the house. The Chazal Omru, the rabbis say in the Gemara, Shehem atarnagolim anifradim min anekevot hapatumim. These are like the fattened hens that are kept away from the nekevot, from the female hens. Capons, probably, yeah. That's what he says. Look at the next word. Shehem shmeinim ma'od nikraim capons. Exactly what he says. These are capons. Here comes the bombshell. So you'll say to me, with all of this food, how many people did he feed? Here comes the real revelation. Alright? After all of the calculation which I've done, which I didn't go through here in section C, he says, "Hanitan le'echol, l'chol ish," everything that was given for everyone to eat. "Vayam maspik l'shishim elef ish b'chol yom." Blows your mind. 60,000 people every single day. He was feeding 60,000. My only comment to this is just imagine how many cornflakes they got through. It's a staggering number. You know, I mean, I work in food services during the day, and we're feeding like, you know, kosher food service, we're feeding 200 people. And that's a ton of food. 60,000, I just can't begin to comprehend it. I don't know. Is there anything comparable to this even today? I know the Queen has, you know, sort of the, in terms of the palace and all the different palaces, how many people she's feeding on a daily basis, but I don't think it's 60,000. It really isn't. And that's it. You're feeding the whole of Yankee Stadium every single day, every day of the 40 years. This is what's going on. It's remarkable. It's beyond remarkable. I don't know. Look at D. I mean, again, I'm just bringing this because it just is so mind-blowing. D is something I just wanted to share with you because what we're seeing here, of course, is begging the question which we spoke about, which is, what about the limitation of the Torah? The Torah says, you know, lo yar belo, you shouldn't have too many of this and too many of that. So look at section D and you'll see something very interesting. I think this is really important. Section B at the top I just brought in from Rav Ginsburg, who was one of the modern writers. He lived in Denver. This commentary was published in 1945. I presume he came originally from the Haim. He came from... he's a good Litvak as far as I can see. But this commentary, which is online, if you want to look it up, HebrewBooks.org, it's actually available to look up the whole commentary there on the whole of Tanakh. It's a very wonderful resource. That whole webpage is very interesting. But just look at D. So I'll just show you a little bit of this as well. Because we saw in chapter 5 about the horses. So listen to what he says. The fact is that the whole number of horses is incredible. He says, and the Abarbanel probably did some research. Nowadays he would say he Googled, but in those days he probably sent letters all over the different continents, trying to find out, are there any kings who have such a large number of horses? And I didn't find anything in the records of the earlier kings. Any king who ever lived, that he would keep such a large army, 40,000 or 400,000, whatever it was, of horses with riders. There's the, you know, it's not wartime. And Shlomo did it. Now it's interesting. He explains. He says, 40,000 horses. Now, are we going to say this was just for his own self-glorification? And he says, the Barbanel says, no. He says, you might argue it was l'tiferet, that he's doing it for his own glory. That'll have all these people running before him. That may be an explanation. But he says, no. This is the point I really wanted to get to. He says, the rabbis say in the Gemara Sanhedrin, Shlomo was actually transgressing what the Torah says. Al velo yar belo susim. Torah says not to have so many horses. And of course, the same argument can be used about the wives. It says, lo yar belo nashim. And he had 1,000 wives. So, you know, what's going on here? What is Shlomo's rationale for all of this? He says, surely he didn't need it for war, so why did he have so many horses? This is so interesting. Barabbanel says, you know what? I want to suggest, he didn't do it for his own, you know, sort of self glory. He wasn't that sort of guy. He says, I didn't do it in a bad way. This was an incredible etzah, something which he did with incredible wisdom. You know what? It's basically the survival of the strongest. Not necessarily the fittest, in this case the strongest. If he can show he's got such an entourage waiting to come out of the stables at any time, then everybody's going to stay away from him. They're not going to start war with him. They're not going to go near him. You know, he's got such a reputation that they'll say he's got 40,000 stables. All of a sudden, probably they'll exaggerate and they'll say he's got 4 million stables. You know, the whole thing will become so powerful, just the reputation, that will keep any enemy away. And it worked for 40 years. Remarkable. And to a certain extent, I suppose this is what we sort of live with in this world. The arms race and everything that goes with it, but it's not such a great situation. But in those days, it worked much better. He says, Yireimoto, they feared him. V'ayu nichna'im lefanav. We saw that they were humble before him. V'magishim elav mincha. They would even bring him presents, you know, just to try and keep on his good side. Ma'ashlo ayosim heim Lo hayu yodim shayu lo kol kach recho parashim v'sosim shuchal l'kovsham kasher yitzah. And of course, without all of this army that could conquer whenever he wanted, they wouldn't have been so kind to him. V'yoter ra'oi haya lasot zeh. It was, in fact, Shlomo did all of this. Mibnei hashalom ilasot milchama. He felt that to keep such a large number of horses in the stables was the way of securing peace. So interesting. Hinei imkein kana Shlomo shalom. Shlomo acquired peace, malchut of the kingdom, achnaat oivav, and the enemy was as it were humble before him, besusav with his horses, parashav with his riders. Ulechein hechazik b'hem. That's why he kept them going. Vegam mash zachash oilo shnei masalef, etc., etc., and the whole list that it goes on. It's unbelievable. And again, I don't know what to say. But, you know, Shlomo was the ultimate exponent of so many things that we're used to in the world. The idea of keeping ahead in terms of armaments, because this is clearly what Israel tries to do the whole time, certainly today. Today it's much more difficult because the enemy has woken up. You know, not like the Six-Day War where they thought just by numbers they would win. The reality was, after the Six-Day War, they all had a reality check and realized it's about the quality of what they're using and the people who are, you know, flying the aeroplanes, not just having the aeroplanes. And of course, this is kind of the scary part of the world we're living in today. But the phenomenal thing of what we see of all of this is Shlomo's chokhmah in the most practical sense. And this is what's so inspiring here. It's so wonderful just to see someone who, you know, really put a tremendous amount of effort, not just into his own personal glory. And the Barbano argues that if that really wasn't an issue for him, we can always sort of disagree with that because there is a certain amount of opulence in what he's doing, unless we see it all as a means of becoming closer to God, which is one of the explanations that some of the Forshim want to suggest. But whatever way you understand it, you know, he's keeping such a large army and feeding such a large army, and even with the wives, he showed that, you know, he was like a Middle Eastern king who all around, they all had big harems. His harem was bigger than everybody else's. And of course, having 1,000 women like that was, again, a statement to the rest of the world that, you know what, Shlomo was a bigger king than all of them put together. And because he kept this reputation so, so strong for so many years, he managed, therefore, to keep the enemy at bay. And it's interesting, only when you get to Perek Yud Aleph, chapter 11, and you see that Shlomo begins to compromise, and the women begin to affect him in a negative way, then all of a sudden everything begins to fall apart. And by the time he dies, it's almost as if he's just like a footnote in history and he's gone. The concept of maintaining such a system like this is very, very challenging. I'm not saying it's impossible, but it's certainly very challenging and it's very interesting to read about. Number one, from the text about Shlomo, and as I tried to show you here, also from the text of the Abarbanel, to give us some sort of modern day comparison. All I can say is that, you know, we can only hope and pray that Mirz Hashem one day will get back to Tachat Gafno, Tachat Teinato. You know, there are people who sort of, you know, once they get to Eretz Yisrael, they're my wife's uncle, I always remember, he took a great pride in showing, every time we visited him in the kibbutz, in Kibbutz Lavi, he had his etrog tree, and he had his lemon tree, and his fig tree, you know, and he would quote these psukim, that, you know, nowadays we have the opportunity to revisit so much of what we read in Tanakh. It's happening again, that we can be under our fig trees, and under our vines, and Bezrat Hashem, in a situation of peace, maybe speedily in our days. We'll leave it there. Mitzvah Shem to be continued next week. Thank you, everybody.